vanished today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration shut down an office that used to keep track of former Gitmo detainees after their release. Now it's not clear where some of the former detainees are.
This office had really done crucial work making sure that people they put in other countries were getting what they needed so that they wouldn't return to the battlefield.
One of those ex-inmates was tracked down in Syria. And later, Boeing added a new safety feature to its planes but didn't tell the pilots.
Boeing said, we did not feel that the average pilot would be served if he was inundated with this information.
The result was a crash in Indonesia.
To be blunt, our lives and our passengers that we protect every day count on us knowing our airplane.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us. When's the last time you heard about Gitmo? It's been a while, right? Gitmo is the American military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the U.S. sent terrorism suspects in the years after 9/11, including the accused mastermind of the 2001 terrorist attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He's still in Gitmo, along with a couple of other dozen detainees, but hundreds of other former inmates are gone, released under the Obama administration, as our partners at Frontline reported last year.
The detainees have been scattered around the globe, taken in under secret deals.
Bodyguard for Osama bin Laden is now free after being held for 14 years.
None of the officials involved in these deals will discuss the details, but most of the detainees were sent to Arab countries.
Many of those former detainees were repatriated to their home countries, but some were not. They were sent instead to third countries that agreed to take them in after negotiations with Washington. The U.S. government used to have an office that kept track of released Guantanamo detainees, but last year the Trump administration shut it down. Carol Rosenberg of McClatchy has been looking at what's happened to the former detainees since that office was closed. We reached her today in Guantanamo.
This office had really done crucial work throughout the Obama administration, following up on the transfers, keeping in touch with government, coordinating through the Red Cross, making sure that people they put in other countries to give them a new start on life were getting what they needed so that they wouldn't return to the battlefield. And then, based on our investigation, the Trump administration lost track of some of them. And we found a couple.
I want to hear about some of the stories, but just give us a big picture. What did you find?
The first thing we found is that there was no one in the Trump administration to talk to about the follow-up. We found that attorneys for these men who were trying to improve arrangements for the men who'd been settled, particularly in Europe, found no one on the other end of the phone. We found that the Red Cross was probably filling the breach, but we got no response from the State Department when we would ask about what happened to these people. The intelligence community went dark, so we went about trying to track them down ourselves. One of the things I did is I went and spoke to the former special envoy for the closure of Guantanamo, Ambassador Lee Wolosky, who had arranged these deals. He said it's one thing for them to decide not to do transfers, right or wrong, but the office had been following up on these deals. And what he found was when he returned to private life as an attorney in New York City, people were calling him to try to solve problems with transfers because there was no one on the other end of the phone at the State Department.
Wow.
He said they called him because they couldn't find anyone.
So let's talk about a few examples. There's former captive Abu Wael Diab. He's Syrian, was released and was living in Uruguay until last summer. Then what happened to him?
He vanished. The Uruguayans said that they had established that he walked across the frontier to Brazil and caught a flight to Turkey. Syrian intelligence established that he was in South Central Turkey, and they say going in and out of Idlib, Syria, which, as we say in the article, is like the perfect storm of what the U.S. does not want for a former Guantanamo detainee. They do not want them going to, you know, a portion of the world where there's U.S. forces. This man was held in the detention center here at Guantanamo Bay. He was force-fed. He made clear his enmity towards the U.S. military. And the goal of these resettlements were to make sure people didn't end up in countries where there were U.S. forces. And the other thing is that we didn't find that every case was a disaster. We didn't find that, in all these instances, people returned to the battlefield. What we learned is that some of these deals made by the Obama administration were well-intentioned, but to countries that were completely culturally incompatible. These are Muslim men from Middle East countries who may speak English, you know, don't speak most of the European languages. And in some instances, they just couldn't figure out how to absorb.
You know, Carol, I keep thinking of this thing Trump said on the campaign trail.
This morning I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open, And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
Yeah, so, Carol, with former detainees no longer on our radar screen with this office closed, what's it like to be in Guantanamo right now?
You know, it sometimes feels like the forgotten end of the earth. People don't really remember that there's a terror prison down here. And especially, I have to say, for those five men who in the prison who are cleared to go, it must feel especially so.
Carol Rosenberg reports on Guantanamo Bay for McClatchy, which owns the Miami Herald. She's been speaking with us from Guantanamo. Carol, it's always good to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
The prison in Guantanamo was set up to keep terror suspects out of the United States and out of the U.S. court system, one concern being that if the detainees were tried in the U.S., they could become a security risk. The Secretary of Homeland Security oversees a lot of the country's safety. The current Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, is reported to be on the outs with President Trump. Why? Juliet Kayyem is here to explain. Kayyem was a Homeland Security official under President Obama.
You know, we used to think during the campaign that the president's talk of a wall was, you know, just a sort of, you know, he didn't really believe in the wall. He couldn't think that immigration enforcement was that easy. And I think it turns out that he actually believes that. And so the challenges of enforcing a border and having lawful migration at the same time make him unhappy. And so he's focusing his ire on Secretary Nielsen.
It's still kind of surprising because Nielsen has gone to the mat for President Trump last June at the height of the White House's family separation policy on the U.S.-Mexico border, and many Americans calling the policy inhumane and cruel. And many of them thought Nielsen wasn't personally going to support it. But publicly, she came out swinging.
Congress and the courts created this problem, and Congress alone can fix it. Until then, we will enforce every law we have on the books to defend the sovereignty and security of the United States.
Juliet Kayyem, was Nielsen's defense of the child separation policy believable?
No, she lied then, and she actually ended up having to, I guess one would say, unlie what she was saying. At that moment, Secretary Nielsen became the spokesperson, the enforcer, the enabler of the family separation policy. She denied to the American public that there was, in fact, a policy, even though everyone knew that there was. And she failed in basic management skills to properly assess and document where these children were going so that when unification was necessary, we would know where the children are. It was so bad as just a pure management issue that almost several months since the separation policy ended, there are still at least about 100 children who are not unified.
So there are these reports you may have seen that Trump has actually berated Nielsen during cabinet meetings.
Yes.
And actually started calling her a Bushy.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, she had been affiliated with the George Bush administration. She had served in the Homeland Security staff at the National Security Council. She had been criticized for some of her responsibilities during the Hurricane Katrina response. And his frustration with the inability to get money for the wall, the inability to stop the caravan or just to stop the flow of people between the South, the Mexico and the United States. He always blamed her as if one, we didn't want that kind of mobility between Mexico and the U.S. There's most of it is lawful migration, and also as if it could be stopped by merely getting the wall. The forces against the wall are much bigger than Secretary Nielsen, including Republicans in border states who are
right.
not funding the wall.
Now, one name that comes up a lot in discussions about a new head for Homeland Security is Thomas Homan,
yes.
former acting director at ICE. What do you know about him?
So ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Homan was acting head in the early year, maybe year or so, of the Trump administration, a true believer in the idea that migration is really about unlawful migration, takes enforcement very seriously, not known to have a soft spot for any of the dramas or concerns or humanitarian efforts. He will be a bull. And, you know, you think Nielsen is harsh. the department is not just the immigration department, although it seems that way now under the Trump administration. It's in charge of emergency management. Look at the fires in California, of cyber. Look at the election hacking, of Secret Service, and protecting our VIPs. I mean, it is much bigger than a caravan or people coming over the border. And Trump, if he puts Homan in, will have successfully moved the Department of Homeland Security from a focus on terrorism and other threats to a sheer focus on immigration enforcement. That puts the homeland at risk in my mind.
Juliet Kayyem, a former official in the Department of Homeland Security under Barack Obama, now at Harvard. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Brutalism, a style of architecture best captured in big, boxy buildings made from exposed concrete, almost prison-like. It was popular in many parts of the world from the 1950s to the 70s, but one of its most iconic examples, some would say unpleasant examples, is right down the road from me here in Boston, City Hall. So how'd that happen? My WGBH colleague Edgar B. Herwick III has that story.
In the mid-20th century, Boston was in a financial and cultural rut and needed a jolt. Flush with $40 million in federal funds, the city cleared some 1,000-plus buildings to make way for a new government center. Its centerpiece, City Hall, was a bold, ambitious statement. In a WGBH TV special from 1968, host Michael Ambrosino gave a glowing review of Boston's new modernist structure and the sweeping plaza surrounding it.
The plaza not only presents City Hall, but it extends right into it. City Hall's the backdrop, and we've got to look closely at it to sense the mood that it creates on the plaza.
If you had to describe the mood that it creates here on the plaza, what would you say?
Mildly oppressive.
Too stern, you know? Kind of overwhelming.
It's rough.
Sad. That building is not beautiful.
Looks like a jail, maybe,
yeah,
a little bit.
That's what I was thinking, actually.
I think it's ugly as hell.
Now, you don't have to work hard to find opinions like those around here. And yet,
it will go down in history as one of the exemplar works of the 20th century.
That's Chris Grimley, architect and co-author of Heroic, Concrete Architecture and the New Boston. And this is how he defines brutalism, the style associated with buildings like Boston City Hall.
The quick definition of brutalism is, there's no real quick definition, but if you wanted to pigeonhole it, it's a building made out of concrete that's very expressive in its design.
The brutalist movement was a reaction to the rise of steel and glass. Buildings designed to be more honest, expressive, and heroic. And Grimley's is not just a local hot take.
Boston City Hall is something like the Taj Mahal of brutalism.
Felix Torker is a Berlin-based architecture historian and a member of a group called SOS Brutalism. They're dedicated to the study and preservation of brutalist architecture all around the world. He says Boston City Hall may be the single most influential building of the entire movement.
The Boston City Hall, in particular, established a whole new building archetype.
Buildings modeled on it, or near exact replicas of it, went up throughout the 1960s and 70s, from a library in Australia to a public swimming hall in Norway.
A bank in the Dominican Republic. We have a Philharmonic Hall in Kyrgyzstan, the parliament in Israel. You really see those Boston City Hall clones in the next decade all over the world, and you can really only understand those looking at the original in Boston.
As for that original, Grimley and his firm are now working with the city to produce a report on the state of the building on its golden anniversary. They'll examine what might be undertaken to conserve and renew it to ensure that it's standing strong to be reevaluated in another 50 years. For The World, Edgar B. Herwick III, Boston.
What do bagpipes have to do with Brexit? We've got the free read Leave EU connection next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A few of you might love the sound of bagpipes, but I'm going to guess that most of you would rather not hear the wailing of bagpipes for very long. We get it. And you're in luck. Our next story is about the bagpipe business. And it starts in a workshop about 50 miles northwest of here in Nashua, New Hampshire. The world's April Peavy paid a visit.
Right now, Tom's making two sets of our Great Highland Bagpipes. He's shaping these into the drones themselves.
That's Richard Spaulding, operations manager of Gibson Bagpipes in Nashua. He shows me around the shop. I admit, I was expecting to hear bagpipes.
It's amazing, like, with the machinery. It's just like regular woodworking.
It's all lathes, all just lathes.
The place reminded me of my dad's woodworking shop in our backyard when I was growing up. Only my dad didn't make bagpipes.
It's about 8 working days to get 2 sets of pipes done.
It's a small shop with only 4 full-timers and 3 part-timers. Spaulding says there are challenges to making bagpipes by hand in New England.
One, it's a Scottish instrument that's being made in America when you have companies in Scotland. We have to fight for our space in the market.
Another challenge, the wood. Gibson uses African blackwood for their Great Highland pipes, you know, the kind you see at parades and funerals. The smaller pipes are made of a tropical wood from Central America called cocobolo.
It's a much lighter colored wood. Has a beautiful grain to it. This is a very dense wood, but not quite as dense as blackwood. It gives a softer tone to it, so it's good for small pipes.
That's Eric Bean. He's in charge of quality control and product development at Gibson Bagpipes. He's also a piper, so he can distinguish subtle differences in wood or craftsmanship.
There's a difference in the tone, the sound it produces, the volume, you know, everything having to do with sound.
I asked him to demonstrate.
With the Great Highland Pipes, or really any of them, it's hard to tell being not being a piper. But pipers, especially experienced ones, can definitely tell the difference.
Just sounds like bagpipes to me. Last year, the UN added both African blackwood and cocobolo to its list of endangered species. Though Richard Spaulding says, technically, these woods aren't endangered.
It's not like ivory, but they want to start watching it before it does become endangered, make sure it's being harvested legally, and there's not a black market that goes on with it.
That entails a lot of paperwork. A quarter of their sales are overseas. It took an entire year for Gibson to get the proper permits to be allowed to export their bagpipes. They're not the only ones.
My name's Alan Waldron from Stirling Bagpipes in Scotland.
I met him this summer while on vacation.
I've had this shop here for 9 years, but I've been making bagpipes for 24 years now.
Hello.
Hi, yeah. Can I help you, my man?
Pop your baby up.
Alan Waldron restores antique bagpipes and also makes new ones using African blackwood, so he's concerned about the paperwork too. But he says he has a bigger worry, Brexit.
I think Brexit is going to be the big problem, where my paperwork to send anything to the European Union will be much worse.
Bagpipes and bureaucracy, a harsh mix that has no borders. For the world, I'm April Peavy.
That story was part of our 50 States project, looking at how the global economy is impacting communities across the U.S. To check out all of our 50 States stories, go to pri.org/50States, 50 States. You heard the Scottish bagpipe maker there. He's definitely not the only one in the U.K. worried about Brexit. And today, the United Kingdom moves significantly closer to making its divorce from the European Union a reality. Prime Minister Theresa May presented her cabinet with a Brexit deal she negotiated with EU leaders, and later she said her cabinet approved it. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story, and he's with me here in the studio. So what happened, Matthew?
This was probably the cabinet meeting of Theresa May's political career. It lasted more than 5 hours, and in it she presented a document. She said it was a compromise with the European Union, almost 600 pages long. This was finally her chance to kind of put some finality and certainty on 2.5 years of negotiations for her cabinet members.
Yeah, and getting to that compromise. So what is in this plan?
May said this is the compromise that will succeed because she says the European Union will buy it. She says this is what the public voted for in 2016 when they voted for Brexit. It will protect British laws, British borders, British jobs, she explained earlier today. Hardline Brexiteers are not so sure. There's a lot of skepticism, including within her cabinet. Marco, the biggest question probably is still what happens with the Irish border. This is what happens with the North, which will remain part of the United Kingdom, and the South, the Republic of Ireland, which will still be part of the European Union.
Yeah, so how is that plan along the Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland border going to work?
Right, so they have a sort of a compromise, you can call it. They're fudging it. Northern Ireland will apparently stay in what's called the EU Customs Union, essentially giving it a special status. Goods, people will be able to cross the border with the sea and with the land with the South. There's a key moment today, earlier though, Marco, and that was when the Democratic Unionist Party leader, this is a small party from Northern Ireland that Theresa May's governing coalition depends on. Arlene Foster is the party leader's name. Here's some of what she had to say today.
It certainly doesn't appear that we would be able to support it because it breaches the red line in terms of having differences between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom in terms of regulation. Obviously, we would still be in the customs union as well, and we cannot have that.
And Matthew, I gather we did finally hear from Prime Minister May herself. What did Theresa May have to say about where Brexit is at right now?
Yeah. After the cameras were there for hours looking at the number 10 Downing Street door, May emerged after dinner, but in time for the evening news.
The Cabinet has just had a long, detailed and impassioned debate on the draft withdrawal agreement and the outline political declaration on our future relationship with the European Union.
I think it's safe to assume that when she said impassioned debate, that means there could have been some arguing in that room. Also, if you listen closely, you could hear the jeering and the protesters making a ruckus in the background. This is a hugely divisive issue in Britain. But Theresa May also said that her cabinet eventually agreed on this deal.
When you strip away the detail, the choice before us is clear. This deal, which delivers on the vote of the referendum, which brings back control of our money, laws and borders, ends free movement, protects jobs, security and our union, or leave with no deal or no Brexit at all.
So, Matthew, briefly, what's next?
Well, the Prime Minister will go to Parliament, and I think it's safe to say we can expect a more impassioned debate.
The World's Matthew Bell. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Hurricane Maria destroyed farms in Puerto Rico. Now a group of women farmers are coming together to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Nobody else is going to help us. We need to help ourselves.
That story, plus why Greece has more than a passing interest in Brexit. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's been a crazy day of back and forth over Brexit, and that's just within the Prime Minister's cabinet in the UK. As you heard a moment ago, it backed a deal today formalizing Britain's split with the European Union. The UK is due to leave at the end of March, but there will still be more deal-making after that. There's also some ancient history to be dealt with. Some in Greece think Brexit negotiations may provide an opening for them to right a historic wrong. Valerie Hamilton has more.
What would you do if you lost something that you really, really wanted back, and then fate handed you a way to get it?
What we have now is the only opportunity in 200 years to force the return of the Parthenon marbles.
That's Alexis Manthiakis, a founder of an international activist group dedicated to the Parthenon marbles, sculptures that were carved in the 5th century BC for the Parthenon, the most famous temple of ancient Greece. For a lot of Greeks, they're hugely symbolic, like an ancient Statue of Liberty.
What does Shakespeare mean to England? St. Paul's Cathedral.
That's the late Greek actress and politician Melina Mercouri in 1982.
The Parthenon marbles are our pride. They are our identity.
The problem is, half of the Parthenon marbles are in London. More than 200 years ago, a British lord took them from Athens and sold them to the British government. Since then, Britain has refused to give them back. Manthiakis thinks Brexit is a good time to ask again.
Our side should say, look, chaps, you know, we would like one thing from you, and that's to have our marbles back, the stolen, looted marbles.
Here's his reasoning. The UK wants lots of things from the EU, a clean divorce, a trade deal, a cooperative future relationship. Greece, as a part of the EU, wants something from the UK too.
There is no blackmail. This is political bargaining. I mean, Britain's doing it right now with Brexit. They're doing it all over the place.
Here's how it could work. Once Brexit happens, the UK and the EU have to negotiate a whole new relationship. The treaties that come out of those negotiations will almost certainly have to be ratified by all 27 EU parliaments. If Greece's parliament says no, there's no deal. Not everyone thinks that's a great idea.
Greece is one country, Valerie, and there are how many countries in the European Union? And I'm not sure that they would be willing that this should be the bargaining chip.
Marlene Godwin is with the British Committee for the Reunification of the Parthenon Marbles. She wants the marbles returned to Athens too, as do many Brits, if you believe the polls. But as a European, she's skeptical about how blackmailing Brexit might go over with the rest of Europe. And as a Brit, she says Brexit is messy enough already.
There's not that many months to go, and there's still no answers. So I don't think that the bargaining chip of a peerless work of art is going to really make any difference to that trade agreement whatsoever.
Legally, Greece does have the power to throw a wrench into that post-Brexit machine. The question is, does it have the nerve? Simon Usherwood thinks probably not. He's deputy director of the think tank UK in a Changing Europe. He says no matter how much Greece wants the Parthenon marbles back, it's likely to care about its relationship with the EU more.
Let's imagine that everyone else signs off on this deal and then it's just the Greeks holding out because they want the marbles. I think there would be a lot of internal pressure in the EU on Greece to say you can't hold this process up.
Don't forget, just a few years ago, during the Greek financial crisis, there were people in the EU calling for Greece's own Grexit. Usherwood says Greece is out of the doghouse now, and it doesn't want to go back. So chalk this one up to Greece's future over its past. As the UK moves away from the EU, the Parthenon marbles will probably stay where they are. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton.
The outcome of all the Brexit deal-making and whether there is a deal in place next March could make a big difference for many Brits at their dinner table. That's because food distribution in the UK is tied to an international food system, and it depends on food imports from outside the British Isles. John Whitehead is one of the directors of the UK-based Food and Drink Exporters Association. How and why would Brexit affect the food industry?
Well, very badly. Because we import a lot of our foodstuffs in the form of both ingredients and finished products. For example, in the wintertime, we import most of our salads. 95% of our lettuce is imported. I guess in much the same way that you in the northeast of the USA bring your lettuce from California and Florida.
Right.
It's due to seasons.
So that's imports. Let's go to the exports, because that's one of your main focuses. What exactly produced in the UK will no longer be exported to the continent?
Well, a number of products are going to be very badly affected. For example, our fresh lamb. We export a very large proportion of our lamb to Europe, particularly to the French market. Now, we can't afford any delays at the customs with fresh meat. The meat will go off and people will just not ship to France. They'll have to find other markets for it.
Are there other markets that you can turn to that aren't in the EU to offset the loss?
Well, we would then look probably to the Middle East, to the Gulf. We might look to across the Atlantic and ship frozen meat to North America. Now, in terms of seafood, the UK, by and large, exports most of the fish it catches and imports a lot of the fish it eats because of species. And if there were holdups in our ability to export, the fishing industry would be badly affected. And likewise, our supply chain on fresh seafood coming in is going to be affected.
I mean, I'm just trying to find a silver lining to this cloud. Locally consumed and produced seafood, doesn't that make some sense?
Yes, it does, if we catch the species that the local consumers will eat. But at the moment, we catch a very large amount of mackerel. the market for the mackerel is to the Far East, where they prefer eating mackerel to us in the UK. We can't get consumers overnight to decide that instead of eating Icelandic or Norwegian cod, they'll start eating mackerel. That's the problem.
And in preparation for a hard Brexit or any Brexit, what are countries on the continent doing to prepare for this?
I think that many food manufacturers on the continent are hoping it's not going to happen. I think if I were a salad producer, tomatoes, lettuce, fresh greens in Spain, I would be extremely concerned, and I would be looking at just what I might be able to do. Because if there's any delay there, we're going to see that lorries are backed up for miles and miles and miles with rotting food on board.
So lorries like trucks?
Yeah.
John Whitehead is one of the directors of the UK-based Food and Drink Exporters Association. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Food, clothing and shelter, the essentials. We stick, though, with food for this next story. It's about farms and farmers in Puerto Rico who were hit hard by Hurricane Maria last year. The island's government estimated the storm wiped out 80% of the value of crops on the island. But soon after, some small farmers began helping each other rebuild with a new focus on sustainability and resilience. Paige Flager has that story.
We're going to dig about maybe 1.5 feet depth.
High in the mountains of Aibonito in central Puerto Rico, a group of farmers drive pickaxes deep into the soil of a guava orchard. They struggle to keep their balance on the steep hillside as they dig a trench called a swale. It's a way to retain rainwater and reduce erosion.
So you end up storing most of your water in the soil itself so the plants can access it whenever they need it.
Daniela Rodriguez Bezosa is a farmer in Aibonito. She's part of the Circuito Agroecológico Aiboniteño, a small group of mostly women farmers who have been spending one day each week for the last year working on each other's farms.
Maria hit, and it was an eye-opener for a lot of people, and it was also like a call to action. Like, nobody else is going to help us. We need to help ourselves. And how do we help each other?
Right now, there are 5 active farms in the Circuito, and often the members are joined by other volunteers from around the island. The group has been working together since the hurricane both to clean up and to help implement sustainable farming techniques.
It gives us the opportunity to help out with like bigger tasks that need to be done. And also, it's not just any people. You have a bunch of farmers coming in, sharing their knowledge, sharing their experiences. So it's also served as a beautiful educational tool for us where we're teaching each other.
The orchard the Circuito is helping out on today belongs to Janet Gavajan.
The best part from this hurricane crisis was that we get to organize to help each other to recover.
Gavajan is a retired chemistry professor and is relatively new to farming. She says working with the Circuito has taught her ways to be more sustainable.
I'm getting ready, not for the hurricane, but for the farm, for the benefit of the whole ecosystem.
These farmers have come to see sustainability as synonymous with resilience and independence. They hope that if they rely more on themselves, they'll be better prepared for the next hurricane, or at least they'll be better able to recover. And there's science to back up that sentiment. Farms' resilience to extreme weather events like hurricanes has been linked to their size and diversity. Or, as Rodriguez Bezosa puts it,
it's kind of like the classic don't put all your eggs in one basket.
If a farm only grows one crop and it's destroyed, there's nothing left. But if a farm is biodiverse, some crops may be lost while others might survive. Jessica Collazo's farm is a few miles away on another small plot of land carved into the mountainside. A couple of baby chicks and a few thin beds of fruits and vegetables dot the plateau. After Maria, we had nothing, Collazo says. She and her husband support their family by selling produce at local markets, but the storm washed their crops, their seeds, and much of their soil down the mountain. The Circuito has helped the family get new seeds and clear fallen trees. Members have also helped build banks and swales as a hedge against the next big storm.
Normalmente, a mí sola y mi esposo nos hubiera tardado meses.
On my own, that would take me months, Collazo says. But with help, it only took a few hours. She hopes that the extra hands and expertise of other farmers in the circuito will help the family reach its goal of becoming a completely self-sustaining farm.
Por ejemplo, para mí,
I want to have my own well for water, so I don't need to rely on the government, she says. I want solar panels, so I don't have to depend on the utility. Those changes are already in place at Daniela Rodriguez Bezosa's farm in Ay Bonito. After Maria, she installed solar power and a rain catchment system. And even before the storm, the farm had diversified its crops, so that after Maria, they still had fresh food.
We felt like the richest people in the world. To actually have greens on our plate was like such a luxury.
By sharing the foundations of sustainable farming, Rodriguez Bezosa hopes she can help her community feel as rich as she did when the next hurricane comes. For The World, Paige Flager, Ay Bonito, Puerto Rico.
Do the letters BTS mean anything to you? No? Well, what about this? That's the tune, Fake Love, one of the biggest hits by the Korean boy band BTS. 168 million listens on Spotify as of this afternoon. These guys are a big deal all over the globe.
Cue the facts and figures.
And that's my colleague Adele Robbins, one of the music hosts on BBC One in the UK, so she knows what she's talking about.
The most famous K-pop group in the world.
Oh, God. Do I really have to do this voice, Abby?
Number one on iTunes in over 65 countries.
Please tell me there's no more.
First K-pop group to break into the UK top 50 and US top 30.
All right, so BTS is big. But as they say on VH1, behind the scenes, all is not well. A Japanese TV network canceled the band's appearance on one of its shows after they found out that one of the BTS members had been photographed wearing a controversial T-shirt. The shirt appeared to celebrate the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. There was a picture of a mushroom cloud on the T-shirt. Then came reports that some of the other members of BTS had been photographed wearing hats with a Nazi symbol on them. After days of silence, the band finally apologized yesterday. Its management company issued a statement that said in part that the artists do not regard war or atomic bombs lightly and that they had no intention of hurting anyone. Not clear yet what this controversy will do to the biggest K-pop band in the world, but for right now, and especially in Japan, it has dimmed their star power. A little over 2 weeks ago, on October 29th, a seemingly routine Lion Air flight took off from Jakarta, Indonesia. 13 minutes later, the Boeing 737 crashed into the ocean. There were no survivors. Now experts say Boeing withheld information from the pilots that may have contributed to the crash. Dennis Tager is a 737 pilot and spokesman for the pilots' union at American Airlines. I asked him to explain what may have happened in the Lion Air cockpit.
If I take what Boeing has described to us, they've linked the Lion Air crash to an erroneous AOA gauge. AOA is the angle of attack gauge. It's an instrument that's on all aircraft, and that is the truest measure of what the wing is doing. When this AOA gauge fails, it triggers an incredible amount of alerts and things that get pilots' attention, but for the wrong reason. So confusion probably reigned really high in the cockpit. You know, there's a human component. You don't just immediately go, okay, here's what we have. There's moments of processing what's going on. While that's happening, as described by Boeing and the FAA, the aircraft is starting to take control of itself. When that data stream, that gauge, isn't sending proper signals, that could trigger another automated system that we were not aware of that automatically induces a nose-down direction without pilot input in a way that is completely counter to the actual condition of the aircraft. And this new feature is not a problem in a sense that it's performing a function that is supposed to add additional layers of safety. But the first problem was we were not notified of this until just a handful of days ago.
As a 737 pilot, what was your reaction to the news?
Well, initially, it was like, I wonder if they did anything wrong in this. What can I learn from this? But as details come out and we see these bulletins come out, you know, got a lot more pilots at very high levels, very experienced, saying, wow. Boeing, in a Wall Street Journal article, said, we chose against disclosing this information to the pilots because we did not feel that the average pilot would be served if he was inundated with this information. We were very outraged by that statement. And our response was, to be blunt, go ahead, try us. Our lives and our passengers that we protect every day count on us knowing our airplane.
And how extraordinary is it that pilots didn't know about this new feature?
Extraordinary enough for the FAA to dictate that the bulletin that Boeing sent out to pilots is just a heads up. They recategorized it as an emergency directive. So I would say I'd let their word speak for it. It's got our attention. And I might add that Boeing not informing us of this for whatever reason, they became an outlier in the safety culture. And trust is extraordinarily important in this. But that information now we do have, and we're learning about how it actually interacts with the airplane. And I needed to say that because as difficult as this story is to hear, the fact is the system works and the safety culture is back in check.
Captain, final question. I'm not a good flyer. In other words, I don't like to fly. Should I be worried, and other passengers like me, should I avoid flights with 737 MAX 8 or 9 equipment?
Absolutely not. And the great news is you have an extraordinarily dedicated team of pilots out there, and I think you can reach across the globe that have one core issue in mind, and that's keeping our passengers safe. And when we know all the information about that aircraft, then that brings the whole loop together. So I would not hesitate at all. We fly them every day at this moment right now. Our families are on them. So you should know that the pilots got your back because we're on the airplane with you. And it's more than just our job. It's our call.
Well, thank you for that. That was very reassuring. Captain Dennis Tager, a spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association. That's the pilots union at American Airlines. He's also a 737 pilot. Captain, thanks very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Finally today, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, is well known for encouraging extrajudicial killings as part of his so-called war on drugs. And one reason he's well known for that is because of reporting done by the Rappler online news site in the Philippines. Now Rappler is being accused of tax evasion by Filipino authorities, something Rappler's CEO, Maria Ressa, strongly denies. Maria Ressa joins us now from Malaga, Spain. How are you reading this move by the Duterte government? Does it come down to, you think, the critical reporting you've been doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is just a logical extension of the illogical nature of the charges against us. I believe it's a strategy of political harassment, of intimidation, to try to get us to stop writing stories that attempt to hold a very powerful government accountable. The tax evasion charge is interesting because it comes several months after the tax agency gave us an award for being Revenue Region 7's top corporate, one of the top corporate taxpayers.
Really? And now you're being charged with tax evasion.
This is the irony of it, right? I mean, there is a physical track record in the real world. So you can't just turn things upside down. Track record matters.
So you're in Spain. Are you going to go back to the Philippines to face these charges in court?
I am definitely going to face them because I run a company. Rappler is a startup. It is majority owned by journalists. Business interests are secondary to us, even though we know we have to survive. But part of the problem is all of this also came out. The government made this decision at a time when Rappler is being honored all around the world for both our journalism and for standing up for press freedom. It's sad for me to see this happen because I was also there when we came out of martial law. I began my career as a journalist in 1986 with the People Power Revolt.
Right.
And now is the pendulum swinging back as I end my career? Or where are we going? And I think it's not just the Philippines, it's globally. The problems that we're facing in the Philippines, the exponential lies on social media, a very authoritarian style president who is our most powerful leader in the last few decades, calling us fake news. That's not new, right?
Duterte is saying that.
So it was interesting because it was a week President Trump called CNN and New York Times fake news. A week later, President Duterte calls Rappler fake news.
I'm curious, though. I mean, Duterte is singling out you and Rappler. Is he taking similar steps against any other news organizations in the Philippines?
It's almost like we all take a turn. At the beginning, soon after he took office in July of 2016, he first focused on the largest broadsheet, the newspaper, Philippine Daily Inquirer. Shortly after that, the largest television station, ABS-CBN, was attacked by President Duterte. And just again last week, he mentioned that they would not be getting a renewal of their franchise. So I guess you become the flavor of the month for whatever reason. Part of the reason Rappler is targeted right now is in terms of filing legal cases, in terms of intimidating us, in terms of the moves that the government has made. It's very clear that we are continuing hard investigative reporting. We are not going to be intimidated, precisely because now more than ever, the mission of journalism is very clear. We need to make sure that any changes in the quality and the state of our democracy, that our public knows what is happening.
Maria Ressa, founder and head of the Filipino investigative news organization, Rappler Media. Great to meet you, Maria. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's where we leave you today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Till tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.